what inflation means for the holiday shopping season, and the federal government begins the massive project of student loan forgiveness. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Washington, D.C., I'm Kimberly Adams in for Kai Rizdal. It's Monday, October 17th. Good to have you along. You may find in your shopping adventures the obligatory Halloween costumes and scary decor, a nod to autumn with your wreaths and table runners ready for Thanksgiving guests. But let's be honest. Even though it's just mid-October, we are basically already in the holiday shopping season. The economy is in kind of a strange place this year, which, yes, it has been in each of the last 2 years, but this time it's for different reasons. Marketplace's Sabri Benishour has more on what we consumers might do and spend on the holidays.
We are probably going to spend more.
This year we're expecting, you know, solid growth, about 5.5% up from last year.
Michael Zdenek is the economics director with S&P Global Market Intelligence. 5% growth isn't bad. It's better than the pre-pandemic average of 3.9% growth, except, of course, for inflation. Factor that in, and it looks like holiday spending isn't going to grow at all.
So in terms of real growth, you know, we're expecting real sales to potentially decline this year, about 0.2%. This is the first time in 30 years since we've started tracking this data where the rise in prices has outpaced the rise in spending.
Another way of saying that is we're going to spend more and get less. There is an exception to this, and it is online.
Online retail inflation has actually slowed, and we're seeing overall online prices down a little under a percent year over year.
Vivek Pandya is a lead analyst with Adobe. Online goods include a lot of electronics and apparel, categories where supply chains have improved or there's a lot of extra inventory. He says there will be real growth for online shopping, about 2.5%, even accounting for inflation. And shoppers, whether it is online or offline, are adapting to inflation.
40% of holiday shoppers say that inflation will change the way they shop.
Ted Rossman is a senior analyst with Bankrate.com, which has conducted surveys of consumers.
That includes seeking out discounts more aggressively, buying fewer items, starting your shopping earlier.
A quarter of holiday shoppers started before the end of September, he says. Another quarter start this month, in part because retailers are offering discounts and offering them earlier. So be on the lookout for Christmas trees in October. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, a bunch of earnings reports seem to have traders feeling good. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Like Sabri just said, a big driver of how people are choosing to spend their money right now is, no surprise, inflation. And one of the biggest obstacles to reducing inflation has been the tight labor market. When there's more demand for workers than available supply, the Fed argues wages go up and so do prices. The central bank uses many different indicators to figure out just how tight the labor market is. This year, it's been relying heavily on job openings data from the Labor Department. But as Marketplace's Justin Ho reports, that data might not be telling us what it sounds like it's telling us.
It doesn't cost anything for Madeline Reeves to advertise a job opening on the website of her marketing and consulting firm, Fearless Foundry.
And while we might leave a role open, you know, hoping that the right unicorn will come along, we may, you know, be able to just continue on without hiring somebody.
Even though Reeves isn't really trying to fill that position, it's still technically a job opening. As a result,
it's totally plausible that that employer could show up in the job opening statistic, regardless of how hard she's trying to fill that role.
That's Preston Mui, senior economist at the advocacy group Employ America. The Labor Department's Job Openings and Labor Turnover Survey, which we often abbreviate as JOLTS, asks employers whether they're, quote, taking steps to fill a position. That could be anything from interviewing candidates to just posting a position online. Mui says the definition doesn't account for how hard the employer's trying.
It could mean, you know, we have an open position and we're trying not very hard to fill it. Or it could mean we have an open position and we really, really want to fill it.
As a result, the JO part of the JOLTS report might be exaggerating how much demand for labor there actually is. Moy says that's a problem, since the Federal Reserve is using that number to help decide how much to raise interest rates and slow down the job market.
That's taking a big risk based on this data. And if they're wrong, and if it's unnecessary, they're going to unnecessarily throw a bunch of people out of work.
Job openings isn't the only data point the Fed is paying attention to. Sarah House, senior economist at Wells Fargo, says there are plenty of others. And all of them are telling us that at the end of the day, the job market is still really tight.
We're seeing it in other measures like the unemployment rate being historically low, as well as initial jobless claims.
House says the indicators that might give us a more accurate picture of job openings are the LT part of the JOLTS report, labor turnover. That includes a tally of the number of people voluntarily leaving their jobs.
For every person quitting, that creates a job opening for businesses. And so just by the sheer higher level of turnover, you are going to get more job openings.
Small business owner Madeline Reeve says she's starting to rethink her hiring process altogether. The same tools that let her advertise job openings cheaply make it really easy for a lot of applicants to apply, whether they're qualified or not.
It's like you're swimming through a sea of junk, and the process has been really draining.
Reeves also isn't sure whether she wants to hire anybody full time right now because she's so unsure about the economy.
I, as an employer, you know, don't necessarily want to carry that ongoing cost of payroll if I don't have guaranteed certainty that I'll have the work to support having people on staff.
Instead, Reeves says she's considering other options, like hiring part-time workers, contractors, or even interns. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
Starting today, you can buy hearing aids over the counter. They're in stores and online at places like Walmart, CVS, and Best Buy. No appointments or prescriptions necessary. Supporters of this change say it's going to make vital technology more accessible and cheaper. Marketplace's Samantha Fields reports.
Until today, getting a hearing aid required seeing a doctor or an audiologist and getting a prescription.
It's mobile visits, and it's several thousand dollars.
Dr. Frank Lin is director of the Cochlear Center for Hearing and Public Health at Johns Hopkins. He says the fact that anyone who's over 18 can now skip all that and just walk into a store or go online and buy a hearing aid.
Oh, so this is huge. I mean, this is fundamentally a huge game changer.
You can now buy a hearing aid for $500 or $800 instead of a few thousand. And Dr. Lin says he expects prices will come down even more in the next few years as new companies start making them.
What I think many people fully expect is these over-counter hearing aids over time will drop to the same price as a good quality wireless earbuds that we typically get, anywhere from, you know, $100 to $200, $300 at the most.
More than 40 million people in the U.S. have some form of hearing loss. And right now, Dr. Lin says only about 20% of them use hearing aids.
We're hoping that because these hearing aids will now be in mainstream stores, that people will start paying attention to hearing health.
Barbara Kelly is with the Hearing Loss Association of America.
I don't think as of today that we're going to see the mad rush.
But she says she hopes over time, as people see them in stores and see the price come down, more will try them. Megan Reed, the director of clinical audiology at Mass Eye and Ear, says the changes that went into effect today are important, but more needs to happen to make hearing aids truly accessible to everyone who needs them.
I don't think over-the-counter hearing aids are a one-stop solution to the problem. It's a first step.
The next step, she says, would be getting insurance, including Medicare, to cover them. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
Coming up,
This field normally should produce around 40 tons of raw sugar cane.
But this year, it's not. First, though, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 550 points, 1.8%, to close at 30,185. The Nasdaq gained 354 points, 3.4%, to close at 10,675. And the S&P 500 was up 94 points, 2.6%, to end at 3,677. Bank stocks rose today, led by Bank of America, which gained 6%. Goldman Sachs banked over 2%, and JP Morgan Chase added 4.2%. The British pound was also up, rising against the dollar today, but it's still short of where it was 3 months ago. The government scrapped the majority of its planned tax cuts, which mostly targeted the wealthy. Britain's FTSE banked 0.9%. Here in the U.S., bond prices rose, the yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 4%, and you're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kimberly Adams. Today, President Biden announced the opening of the application for student loan forgiveness. A beta version started up over the weekend. Beta version meaning some issues are still being worked out. But according to the Department of Education, if you submit an application, it will be processed. With more than 40 million people eligible for debt relief, this is the largest operation of its kind in the department's history. Now, the federal government has struggled with giant logistical operations in the past. Recall the rollout of healthcare.gov if you need an example. Marketplace's Stephanie Hughes has more on how this effort is going.
The application for debt relief almost seems like a form of adult homework, so it might be appropriate that 28-year-old Edward Van Ostrom, who's now a public school teacher, got a nudge from their mom last night to fill it out.
I got off the phone with my mom and she was like, did you do it yet? In the way that moms do.
So Van Ostrom did. They owe about $28,000 in undergraduate student loans. The form was super simple. First name, last name, middle initial optional, social security number, and ticking a box that they fit income requirements. It was all so easy, it left Van Ostrom feeling a little annoyed.
So that's why I was like, well, why couldn't this just be applied automatically? Like, all the information you asked me for, you already have. You're the government.
You know, it's a totally valid point, right?
John Fansmith works in government relations at the American Council on Education. He points out that legally, the IRS can't share information with other agencies. So it's all on the Department of Education to verify income, find out whether applicants received Pell Grants, and eliminate the proper amount of debt.
It's a lot. I mean, multiply that by 44 million people, there's a very complicated process to do something that seems outwardly very simple.
A spokesperson for the Department of Ed says the testing period will help it uncover any possible bugs before the official launch. And there's a lot riding on it. Betsy Mayotte is president of the Institute of Student Loan Advisors.
Consumers, unless they work in it, they don't understand what goes on in the background. So it can be really easy for them to lose patience. I already had people this weekend that filed their application on Saturday and Sunday night were asking why their forgiveness hadn't shown up yet.
Because when you do your homework, especially as an adult, you want credit for it. In Baltimore, I'm Stephanie Hughes for Marketplace.
For a step-by-step guide on how to navigate that student loan forgiveness application and check if you're eligible, head over to marketplace.org. If you happen to be filling out that student loan forgiveness application, or frankly, doing anything else online, it's partly thanks to a United Nations agency called the International Telecommunication Union. The ITU, which recently elected a new leader, may not be as famous as other UN bodies like the Security Council, but it's a pretty big player when it comes to how information moves around the world. Mallory Nodell is the Chief Technology Officer at the Center for Democracy and Technology and an observer at the ITU. Welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me.
What is the International Telecommunications Union, ITU?
So the International Telecommunication Union is one of the oldest, actually it is the oldest standards body, and it's also one of the first UN bodies. It's got a simple mandate. It is meant to help the world communications infrastructure interoperate. So back in the 1800s, they were worried about the telegraph. So it used to be the International Telegraph Union. It got renamed. It's dealt with telephony over the years and now does focus on digital technology, but its mandate is a little bit narrower than you might think because there are other standards bodies that have filled that gap in making the internet work. So the ITU plays a role, but it's a smaller one.
What are some examples of how the ITU has influenced telecommunication standards?
Sure. So one of the really obvious examples would be our telephones, so that we can make phone calls around the world. I can be in one country, pick up the phone, and call a completely different country that might have its own standards bodies, and that the telephone call will go through. There won't be a lot of delay or static. That's pretty revolutionary, and we take it for granted, but it's because the ITU worked on standards around the world for many years to make that happen.
What's the process for something that happens at the ITU, one of these standards, to actually become a policy that affects the technology that you and I use?
The ITU does a lot of documentation. One way that it works is to create regulations. Now, these would be binding, but they take a lot more time, and they're usually pretty narrow in scope because then all of the countries that are parties to the ITU, which is all of them, would have to agree and sign that. When it comes to the internet, and I'll stay in that lane because that's my area of expertise, it's going to be things like how to harmonize emergency services numbers, you know, 911 or other ones. How do you make that work everywhere? The sectors of the ITU are the standardization sector, the radio communications sector, and then the last sector is the development sector. And this is making sure that access to telecommunications technologies is equal, equitable, global. That could be something that all member states would be required to participate in.
The internet is such a huge part of global telecommunications now. What sort of work has the ITU done on standardizing online communications?
There are some public policy issues that it looks at related to IP addresses, over-the-top services, cybersecurity. And remember that the internet was, in the early days, built on top of telephones. So the ITU had been responsible for making sure that telephony was global and access to that pretty universal. But I wouldn't say primary, right? There have actually been other standardization bodies that have created the internet we know today and continue to manage it. So the Internet Engineering Task Force, which I participate in, the Internet Architecture Board, I'm a member of, those are places where people working on internet technology were getting together from the early days and actually coming up with those standards. And through relationship building, managed to get the connections and the implementations that they needed to actually make the internet work.
Mallory Nodell is the Chief Technology Officer at the Center for Democracy and Technology. Thank you so much.
Pleasure. Thank you for having me.
The American West is dealing with an ongoing drought that scientists say in some places is the worst in more than 1,000 years. Conditions are dry from California all the way to the Gulf Coast of Texas. And in a region that depends on water from reservoirs, the levels in many of them are shockingly low. For example, in South Texas, along the lower Rio Grande, two reservoirs supply water to both sides of the border. For the past few years, they've struggled to remain even half full. And right now, one of them, the Falcon International Reservoir, is just 15% full. That's scary news for farmers in the region who grow sugarcane, cotton, citrus, and a whole host of other crops. Marketplace's Andy Euler took a trip there to hear from some of them.
Driving between rows of sugarcane on his farm in San Benito, Texas, Sam Simmons tells me this year's crop just isn't in great shape. We get out of his pickup and take a look. Stay here,
bud. They're basically a section of cane that grows every about 10 to 14 days. And the length of it is according to how much moisture there is.
He says during a normal year, the sections, called barrels, might be 6 to 8 inches long.
But we didn't have enough moisture to really keep it growing rapidly.
He points to a plant nearby where the barrels are less than half the length they should be.
Oh, that's probably three. Some of those are three. Maybe this one might be 3.5.
That means this cane will produce a lot less sugar.
This field normally should produce around 40 tons of raw sugar cane.
In a normal year, he guesses that it translates to about 8,000 pounds of sugar. But this year, he says, if he were a sugar buyer making an offer,
I wouldn't offer more than about 5,000 pounds. Really? So it's probably 40% off. And that I can basically say due to lack of irrigation water.
Pray for rain has always been a common refrain in these parts. Farmers down here can't control what comes from the sky. But until recently, water coming out of the reservoirs along the Rio Grande has made up the difference. That's by law. Specifically, a treaty with Mexico from 1944. And Simmons says right now his sugar cane is suffering because the Mexican government isn't keeping its end of the bargain.
The real fight is with Mexico, them living up their treaty obligations.
The treaty requires Mexico to deliver to the United States enough water to make up for the lack of rainfall on about 100 farms the size of Simmons's every year, on average.
But the way that it's interpreted and the way that it's enforced is they basically have 5 years.
Brian Jones is state director of the Texas Farm Bureau for the Rio Grande Valley.
And it doesn't matter if it all comes on the fifth year or what, even though that, they're severely lacking through these first 2 years of this cycle.
According to the International Boundary and Water Commission, over the past 2 years, Mexico has only delivered a third of the amount of water that farmers had been expecting. The Mexican embassy in Washington didn't respond to a request for comment. The lack of water isn't just stunting sugarcane crops in the area, though. It's hurting corn and soybeans, cotton and sorghum. There's also a bunch of citrus growers down here. Dale Murden's one of them. This grove just south of Harlingen already took a hit during the winter freeze in 2021. Murden says it's holding its own these days, but he's worried about having enough water before the harvest. Even as his own crops are suffering, though, he understands that Mexican water commissioners are in a tough position. Things aren't much wetter on their side of the border, and there are lots of farmers upriver who get water from the Rio Grande, too.
That's a lot of different people to try to get together for the common good, and it's a challenge.
And Merton knows climate change is only making the problem worse.
I've noticed things drying out a lot quicker lately. I had 4 inches last month and 4 inches the month before, but things are just dry. We're really drying out quick for some reason, so that concerns me a little bit.
And if the drought continues or gets even worse, Merton says he might have to sell his farmland. That would probably mean a whole bunch of new homes and apartment buildings here instead of grapefruit and orange groves. In Harlingen, Texas, I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, Since we started the show with shopping habits and inflation, let's end there as well, with one of two interesting bits of data CNBC pulled from the latest Consumer Price Index. First, the war in Ukraine, that drought Andy mentioned, bad weather in Brazil, and an export ban in Indonesia have all crashed together to send the prices of butter and margarine in the U.S. up 32% year over year, one of the more severe examples of food inflation. And for your moment of economic context, another bit of data from CNBC. This time, something that's getting cheaper, sort of. Smartphones. Now, you're probably saying, wait, smartphones are getting more expensive. But the Bureau of Labor Statistics, when calculating the CPI, likes to compare apples to apples. So when smartphones get better, but the price stays the same, the BLS basically treats it as going down in price, which maybe makes you feel a bit better when you're shelling out hundreds of dollars for a new phone, I guess. Our daily production team includes Anais Amin, Andy Corbin, Richard Cunningham, Nicholas Giang, Maria Hollenhorst, Sarah Leeson, Sean McHenry, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Kimberly Adams. We'll see you tomorrow. This is APM.